Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to another episode of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. We'll draw your attention to the new release date, which is Thursday and Friday now for the calendar year 2017. To better accommodate the cycle of retail news that's been adopted over the last 6 to 7 months. During this show, we'll talk changes at Walmart, whether it be layoffs or in the front office. We'll talk about growth at Sportsman's Warehouse and the rebirth of Aeropostale. But we begin in a sector we don't talk a lot about, Western Wear, as Boot Barn releases their preliminary third quarter fiscal 2017 results on Monday. They indicate slower than anticipated growth due to a number of factors. This is for their third quarter that ended December 24th. To give a little background about Boot Barn, they were founded in 1978. 2 years ago, they acquired longtime Western Wear retailer Sheplers, as well as Sheplers.com. So they've been growing through acquisition. They've been growing through new store development. At the same time, their same store sales didn't grow a whole lot, at least in this last quarter.
Yeah, the same store sales definitely leave something to be desired, as they came in at a positive 0.2%. But if you read through the comments made by the CEO, he seems fairly optimistic. He said that despite political headwinds throughout the 2016 election process, and despite warmer than usual weather, they were able to still focus on their physical stores and get things going a little bit better than company expectations. However, this really did fall short of analyst expectations overall. You see that the company is now forecasting for revenue to come in for their third quarter at around $199 million. And this actually represents just a modest 3% increase year over year. This for a company that is growing through acquisition, but is actually growing their store count as well. You see their overall stores did add 7 stores for the quarter, and they now have 219 stores in 31 states. But if you dig a little deeper into Boot Barn operations, I think this will be an interesting conference call to mull over, because as they continue to grow out, they're really not concentrating on having a massive store presence in the regions they are already in. They're more focused on having a more spread out store footprint. And I think this is contributing to the idea that they want to spread out to ensure that they have a strong e-commerce presence overall. They kept mentioning how they wanted to grow online sales, and then they can do this through this grassroots recognition via the physical store. Then if you look at their website in particular, they do now have an email subscription service that allows members to save through promotional discounts on certain items throughout the year, and they also give a one-time promotional discount upon signing up, which is typical in the retail industry. You see a lot of companies having this membership rewards program, but Boot Barn, for their part, their website is extremely logical, and they have a very good use of space. So if you transfer that into the results of the third quarter, I am curious to see how things stack up.
Their preliminary release coincided with a recent presentation at the ICR Exchange Conference for Boot Barn, and there are many interesting things within their presentation. They mentioned that the country lifestyle, or the Western lifestyle, is notably on the rise. They talked about country music being the most popular music genre. They talked about the Ford F-150 currently being the highest selling vehicle. And they talked about pro rodeo being, according to their metrics, the fastest growing sport. So they see a lot of white space within the country to expand. They do have a very spread out store presence, but they see new markets that they can expand into. And what's more, they see a lot of momentum within the Western styles. It's important to note that for Boot Barn, they get only about 50% of their overall revenue from footwear, from boots and other types of work shoes. They get 32% of their overall revenue from apparel, and this is where they see some optimism in. They carry Carhartt brand apparel, which is notable not only in Western wear, but in other facets of everyday life as well. And they carry stylish Western shirts and Western jeans for women, men, and children. And they hope to capitalize on this ongoing fashion movement. When you look and break down their sales by end user, so this is not the person that they actually sell to at the counter, but rather the end user, you see that 60% of everything that's bought at Boot Barn, which again primarily sells Western wear, goes to men, 26% to women. So you see a large amount of growth potential there if you start to market more towards women as well. And that's where they see some of this undercurrent of momentum. But what I think is more notable for Boot Barn, they acquired Scheffler's 2 years ago. And Scheffler's, up until the last few years, had been one of the more popular Western wear websites to visit. In fact, their traffic in the third quarter of fiscal year 2016 was greater than any other Western wear outfitter. Well, Boot Barn, after the acquisition of Scheffler's, between the two companies, they have far more traffic. In fact, almost twice the amount of traffic over the next closest competitor in this space, which would be Country Outfitter, and then you have Cavender's coming in at third place. So there are a lot of things to like as far as the e-commerce presence of this company, but all that being said, they have 200 plus stores in the U.S., and the stores account for 82% of their overall sales during this last fiscal year. E-commerce only accounting for 18%. So you see growth prospects there, and you see growth prospects in terms of the end user, as well as growth prospects in the apparel category for Boot Barn. Now, given all of that, it makes sense that they have a little bit of a hefty price to earnings ratio that would suggest future growth for Boot Barn, even though they're seeing a few setbacks from this most recent quarter. But they did mention the presidential election and the political climate in the United States as being a main reason for this. They saw this as a hindrance on the Western wear category as a whole. And it will be interesting now that some of this political strife at least has slightly died down since the election, where they come in for the next quarter, which will be from December 25th, 3 months on.
Yeah, there were several excuses that were built into this preliminary earnings call, and I am curious to see if they can get past these temporary headwinds and have a strong 2017. And Trent, you make a really good point in that they need to have online sales be a little bit more than 18% if they truly do want to have a strong omnichannel approach like the management is alluding to. But as you talked about, the stock is down a little bit, 6.5% since the preliminary results came out earlier in the week. And then right now, if you look at the current stock price, shares are trading around $11.63 per share. But if you span the timeline out, if you look at the one-year graph for Boot Barn, ticker BOOT, you'll see that the shares are having lows of around $5 and highs of around $17. So this is a typical, highly dynamic stock. As you mentioned too, the price-to-earnings ratio is still growth-centric, sitting around 25 times.
Perhaps the most promising thing for Boot Barn going forward is that they have managed to eliminate competitors through acquisition. They acquired Baskin's Western Wear back in August 2013 and again acquired Scheffler's back in 2015. So right now, especially in terms of a widespread brick and mortar presence, their main competitor is Cavender's Western Wear. They feel like they are placed well in the marketplace to be able to compete with Cavender's, but you also have other players here, including not only local stores, but also larger national chains starting to get in on the Western wear category as that's become more and more popular. So again, you see potential growth going ahead, but they did reiterate to investors that their average inventory per store was lower than their prior year's average inventory per store by about 3%. They noted assistance in their supply chain mechanisms as being reasons for this, and they significantly reduced their amount of borrowing on their line of credit down to $23 million. Their cash and cash equivalents sit at $31 million. So a healthy company, one that is poised for growth, and even though we didn't see a whole lot of growth in this last quarter, we see that they're still building out their presence in terms of new stores. They're still tinkering with their e-commerce strategies, and they're looking towards what should be a healthy calendar year 2017 if they can get some of these headwinds to die down.
We move from a Western wear and work lifestyle retailer to a grocery store operator and food distributor in Super Value, where they failed to meet expectations during their most recent quarter ended December 3rd. So the merchant revealed a net loss for their third quarter fiscal 2017. A report came out on market open Wednesday of this week. Wholesale revenue edged up 0.2% to $1.91 $1.8 billion for the company, while sales in its slightly smaller retail segment fell 3.4% to $1.06 billion. And so when you're looking at SuperValu, you're seeing a company that primarily is a food distributor here in terms of revenue. So you see overall revenue actually tallied up to $3 billion, in part due to their strong supply chain network. However, overall revenue did represent a 1.4% decrease thanks to the sale of Save-A-Lot food stores. But same-store sales for the retail segment decreased a whopping 5.7% for the quarter, and this is something we're going to be focused on here for the purposes of this podcast. This after analyst estimates were already seeing a negative 4.7% for the company. So this is a company that analysts have really looked at and said they don't see a lot of positive aspects in, at least as far as their retail segment is concerned, and they still miss these lower expectations. Again, a net loss came in for SuperValu. They reported a net loss of $11 million for the quarter, or 10 cents a share, and this is compared with earnings of about $3 million or 13 cents per share for the same quarter last year. On an adjusted basis, however, they saw net income rise to $14 million or 5 cents per share. But if you look at the GAAP earnings loss, this had a lot of things built into it. We're talking about a pension settlement charge of about $24 million. And we are continuously talking about the store closure expenses. They came in around $1 million. And then other asset impairment charges for SuperValu tallying over $9 million. So this all had a major effect on their overall net loss for their third quarter. But again, if you look at their overall store segment, you're seeing that they only have five banners now. And Trent, this is a company that really has been struggling to garner customers and has really needed to focus on keeping customers coming to their stores as they keep offering a value proposition.
One might think that they'd use the cash from the completed Save-A-Lot sale during the last quarter to infuse some life into the business, but they're actually using $1.1 billion of the $1.37 billion in cash to pay off some of their debt. And now that they're down to those five banners, as you mentioned, Cub Foods, Farm Fresh, Hornbacher, Shop and Save, and Shoppers, you're seeing also a little bit of the erosion in terms of same-store sales, because Save-A-Lot stores were thought to be a fairly successful banner. We talk a lot about the off-price food segment and how popular that's been. And in fact, just on the last Food Focus episode earlier this week, we talked about Pyramid Foods, which owns a few Save-A-Lot stores, but also King Cash Shaver stores and the success they're seeing with that concept. So again, with the sale of Save-A-Lot off and away, SuperValu now has to look to those five remaining brands and find ways to spruce things up. However, much of this earnings call, at least from a strategic standpoint, was focused on their wholesale business, which is, again, the larger portion of their business. It makes up about two-thirds of their overall revenue. So they're looking to try and be more effective and efficient in the distribution business. But one thing I found interesting, Leighton, is that they talked a lot about merchandising, but as it pertains to distribution and wholesale. They didn't talk a lot about merchandising for their own stores, which might be a slight warning sign for them.
The company has certainly pivoted to the positive aspects of their wholesale business, Trent. And this is one of the things that we had talked about before recording this podcast, in that the company is under a very different dynamic than most grocery store operators, because they have a strong relationship with many of their competitors because they offer a lot of their own private label brands to their competitors. So here we have a company, again, with an existing dynamic that kind of works against them in a lot of different regions of the country. They mentioned a partnership with the Fresh Market, where they had originally piloted distribution to 16 of their stores, but now they're going to be supplying all 178 Fresh Market stores by the end of February. So while this isn't bad news for the company, especially when you're looking at the wholesale division, this is very weird when you're looking at a company that also operates these five banners of grocery stores. So this is an interesting thing too, in that you had talked about the merchandising aspects for the company. They talked about more relevant end caps, standardizing planograms for these supplying operations, and then also local product showcasings. And so, again, as this relates to the wholesale division, I think this is really drawing away their focus from their current existing retail operations. You see that they talk about the need for some more localization into their stores, the retail stores that they currently have, and how they really have been failing to operate effectively, trying to reach different demographics in the regions they are operating in. And so I think this wholesale business really detracts from their focus on the retail operations. However, it was a bit refreshing to see their merchandising focus. We looked through a lot of earnings transcripts, a lot of quarterly earnings results, and a lot of the times, Trent, we don't really see merchandising talk bantered about. So this is a little bit refreshing for the company, but this is a company that had just sold off Save-A-Lot Foods and has been struggling for the retail segment. So you could look at a company like this and really understand why it has been very volatile over the past 52 weeks.
Putting aside, of course, their wholesale and distribution mechanisms, which I think may be indeed the future for the company if we're talking about the true direction that the shareholders would like the company to go, it would not surprise me to see them sell off one by one their remaining five retail brands that they've got. They do have some reasons for optimism on the retail side of things. They mentioned that their e-commerce initiatives have begun to be implemented. You've got a home delivery network for four of their five store banners as of right now, and they want to double the number of digital accounts, which right now sits at 1 million. They want it to be to 2 million accounts by fiscal 2018 for those five brands. And we're talking about digital accounts by those consumers, whether it be for the home delivery network or other mechanisms that they have in place. They try to have a localized feel at each of these five stores, and that's not unique. We talked about Pyramid Foods on the Food Focus podcast doing that. Kroger does the same thing with all of their localized brands, but it seems as though something is just coming up short for Super Value, whether it's not being able to compete on price or whether it's just simply not delivering on the localized aspect of things. After all, we are seeing same-store sales declines in the mid-single digits, which is much more than the current market of food deflation would have it decrease. And when you look at operators like Walmart and Kroger going up by 1 to 2% or sometimes between 0 and 1%, they're still increasing that same-store sales. They're not struggling like this particular food retailer is. And so there might be danger around the bend, but they're trying their best to keep up with the ever-diversifying digital landscape of grocery. Despite that, though, I do think the future for Super Value lies in their wholesale business. When you look at their wholesale business, there's a lot more strength there, not only in terms of the merchandising that we talked about and the reinvigoration towards merchandising, but in terms of the sales-driven culture that they cited the need for. They're talking already in their earnings release much more like a service sector business than a retail business. And I don't think it would surprise us, either one of us, if they were to slowly sell off some of their retail store brands and just focus on the wholesaling aspect of their company.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the Food Focus podcast, which we host weekly as well. And this is something we've talked about with Bob Evans, and that they have a large food distributorship that a lot of activist investors have been saying they should really sell off because it's providing more value, more consistent value than the restaurants that they operate here in the Midwest. So this is a company that really does have a strong understanding of their grocery supply chain business. And this is something that they definitely are not shying away from when they're talking about their business and their business dynamics on their investor relations site. So looking forward, we do see that their share price has been dropped a little bit from this past earnings call. Shares fell over 8% following the results this week, Wednesday. Shares currently trading around $4.24 per share, trading around $4.80 per share on Tuesday before their earnings call. This represents for the company around a $1.05 billion market cap and a dismal price-to-earnings ratio of about 10.3.
We'll now enter our final story of the first segment of the Retail Focus podcast, and we turn our attention to mall retail. Amidst all of the negative articles about mall retail that have come out over the last few weeks, especially since department stores are beginning to release some disappointing December numbers, we get positive news in that Aeropostale is reopening over 500 stores in the United States. Of course, we've discussed Aeropostale many a time on the podcast and covered their progression through bankruptcy. They were bought by a consortium of bidders, and it was a requirement in the purchase that a certain number of stores had to be kept open. Well, in November, we got word from Simon CEO David Simon that they found, when they were looking at the numbers, there's a lot more store profitability available for Aeropostale than they initially thought when they submitted the bid. At that time, they announced intentions to keep at least 500 locations open, but we weren't sure whether or not those were going to be followed through upon. And as it turns out, over 500 stores are reopening in a swath during the next couple of weeks. Some of them have already been reopened, but the idea here for Aeropostale, they closed all the stores down, liquidated certain assets in some, liquidated others completely out, and they're kind of doing a factory reset on their stores to reopen with a new image.
You know, this is sort of a blueprint for how bankruptcy auctions should go, because here you have a consortium, as you mentioned, of different companies coming in and taking control of Aeropostale. It turns out that some of these locations, as you mentioned, were profitable. So here you have Authentic Brands Group, which was one of the partners in this final bid during the bankruptcy auction in September. Well, Authentic Brands, for their part, they own Juicy Couture, Jones New York, and other fashion brands as well. So here they have a partner that is really going to be acting more as a consultant that can really bring life back into this Aeropostale brand. And you see that through a number of different press releases throughout this last week. You're seeing that they are trying to be more positioned to, again, appeal to the younger consumer, because we all know how finicky fashion is, at least in the United States. And so I feel as though this type of partnership with these types of groups is going to be a positive for Aeropostale. And this is something that we've been talking about for a while. Are they going to be able to be successful with reopening all of these locations? And while some were temporarily shut down to try to re-merchandise, I think this is going to be a good thing in that they waited a little bit. They gave consumers a little bit of downtime to kind of forget about the previous Aeropostale brand. And now they're going to reinvigorate, reinfuse a little bit of capital, and they're working with mall management companies to reinsure that they're going to be around for years to come. So I think this rollout, this brand new rollout for the spring of 2017, is really going to give a refreshed look for the company. They talked about having a redesigned logo after its longtime logo is going to be dismissed from the company. I think overall, they're handling this in a very professional manner, and I think they're going to be doing things in a way that makes financial sense.
Oftentimes, when a company goes through bankruptcy and emerges on the other end as an asset for multiple investors, there's a lack of some transparency. It's not as though we can just go to earnings reports and find out information about the company. So we did have to dig a little bit deeper as far as some of the initiatives Aeropostale will be setting forth here in the next few months. Their CEO, Mark Miller, said that overall the company and their associates were excited to reopen, show off the new look of Aeropostale, which, as Leighton mentioned, begins with a new logo, their font in their logo, now in an italicized cursive. If you go to their website right now at aeropostale.com, and Leighton and I have talked about their e-commerce presence being somewhat robust in comparison to other mall retailers, the top of the website now says, get ready to 17 of 17. So February 17th of 2017, with a button right next to it on the right-hand side that implores consumers to become a member today. If you click on that button, it allows you to sign up for email alerts or implores you to sign up for text alerts. Customers that sign up for the first time will receive 20% off their next purchase. And according to Chain Store Age, it's suggested that they're rolling out a new ad campaign in the middle of February that coincides with this February 17th date that's going to underscore the store's transformation. And there's no mention of traditional advertising in the ad campaign. Chain Store Age says that the ad campaign will be supported by in-store signage and also social media efforts. In the past, Aeropostale did devote significant resources to magazine ads, but so far, no mention of that particular mode of advertising. And this campaign is, of course, necessary because, as Leighton mentioned, they received a significant amount of negative press. Aeropostale was lumped in with a handful of other mall retailers that were going down or failing at the time. And we see even now the liquidation of some in-store assets, like what we have now with American Apparel and their in-store functions likely to be liquidated here in the next few months. But as you go deeper into their website, there's a number of other initiatives that seek to be promising for the company. Probably the most notable initiative is their increased effort to market their PS from Aeropostale brand, which is a kids clothing brand designed for those ages 4 to 12. And this is designed, in essence, to compete in what's become a fairly weak kids clothing market. This is another area where we've seen a lot of bankruptcies in. Delia's comes to mind as one of those bankruptcies. But part of what they're doing is marketing this PS from Aeropostale brand in an online-only context. So they're tying it in to a certain extent with their brick-and-mortar stores, but moreover, they're really making the online push, and they're going to be benefited in this aspect because we've seen an increase in cell phone usage, particularly by the 8 to 12-year-old group. And the reason you see an increase in cell phone usage is due in part to the fact that parents, according to various studies, desire to remain connected with their children. If a child has a smartphone, there are a number of tracking mechanisms and apps that parents can use to kind of keep track of where that child is in various different portions throughout the day. If we look back in 2010, a survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that just 31% of kids aged 8 to 10 and 69% of 11 to 14-year-olds had phones. So we see not many children between the ages of 8 and 10 have cell phones. However, just 4 years later, according to the National Consumers League, the number is 56% of children age 8 to 12 now have a cell phone. And now looking today in 2016, the average age for a child to get their first smartphone is 10.3 years. And that's according to Influence Central. Now, the same survey found that 64% have access to the internet via their own laptop or tablet. That compares to just 42% in 2012. So just in 5 to 7 years, we've seen this massive growth in accessibility for those aged 8 to 12 to get online and be able to conduct some of their own shopping. Aeropostale knows this, and this is why it appears as though they've reinvigorated this PS brand, and they're really underscoring it if you go to their main Aeropostale website. They've got some other promotions going on, including offering $10 off a $40 in-store purchase when one clicks on their store locator tab on their website, and that's under a heading that says hello again. So they are referencing the entire bankruptcy and reemergence and restore opening on their website, which I think is good. They're not trying to sweep it entirely under the rug. They are underscoring that they are no longer the same boring Aeropostale, at least as far as the brick and mortar segment is concerned, and trying their hardest to win some of their old customers back.
And in trying to reinvigorate their brand, it is going to require that they're going to be having to hire for new positions. And it appears as though they are hiring for a little bit more positions than usual at their New York headquarters, many of them initiated in December. So this time off has really given them an outside perspective into what opportunities they need into hiring executives into certain roles. Many of these positions are in the merchandising field, and their VP of e-commerce and VP of merchandising planning executive positions remain open. And then you look at the store level, Trent, you see that hiring for assistant managers is around 135 of their 500 stores. So they have 135 positions currently open. And this is according to their own website. Additionally, they are looking for around 33 store managers and about 120 sales leads. This means about 8% of their current reopened stores do not have a permanent store manager as of yet. But again, they are hiring and they are doing their due diligence, trying to research what people fit best for which role. So I think this is a really good thing for the company. I think taking some time off to reanalyzing the market, and you mentioned some key demographics that really are untapped in the current market that they are going to be exploiting. And I think hiring correctly is imperative for a company that wants to see long-term success.
One final note on Aeropostale before we move into the second segment of the Retail Focus podcast. You talk about tapping into some demographics that they feel like to this point haven't been tapped into a whole bunch. You notice also that the price point of a number of their products online has decreased. They've always been known for a robust amount of clearance sales, but they also have continuously ongoing clearance sales on their website, and currently a factory sale going on right now where you can take up to 50% off all items marked with that factory note. However, they do still charge for shipping, at least up to $87. Beyond $87, you can get free shipping on their website. 1987, of course, the year the company was founded, so kind of a throwback to that. But again, it's about price point and the combination of price point and accessibility for Aeropostale. They feel that brick and mortar platform still very important, and never has that been more evident than in the last couple of weeks, where they've spent a lot in terms of resources trying to reinvigorate their brick and mortar stores before reopening.
Move on to a short story about Sportsman Warehouse as they grow their store count by about three following an announcement on Tuesday with openings in Washington, California, and Colorado. For those that are unfamiliar with the specialty retailer, they're a store that operates for outdoor enthusiasts, and they provide hunting, fishing, camping, and backpacking equipment, and they emphasize top quality merchandise and known brands. So if you go into their stores, merchandising is their forte. They are extremely passionate about what they do and what they sell to their customers, and they like to be in regions of the country where you see a little bit more active of an individual. Their motto is they're more than a store, they are your outdoor adventure partner. So again, these stores are going to be in Washington, Colorado, and California, specifically Everett, Washington, and this will be their 10th store in that state. Pueblo, Colorado, where they'll see the 8th store for that state, and Visalia, California, and that'll be their 6th store in that state. But these locations will be open during the second half of 2017, basically indicating that they are under development currently. They will then have 85 stores in 22 states by the year's end. So we see, again, a higher concentration in the states they are already operating in. They have a huge opportunity in the Midwest. What is interesting is that in the Midwest, they only have one store, and that's in Ankeny, Iowa. Outside of that, they really don't have any other locations until you move westward. If you look at their store locator map, it is extremely interesting for Sportsman Warehouse, because pretty much west of the Colorado border, you're seeing that they have a presence in every single state. So they already are in the process of four other openings as well in these areas, but then they also have new stores opening in North Carolina. You see a company that is expanding, but again, expanding in regions they already have a large presence in. You see the other openings that they've started in 2016 happening in Arizona, Washington, and California. So two of those states they are opening these new locations in.
Sportsman's Warehouse is a company that only recently made their initial public offering. That took place back in 2014, so they are a relatively new company. But one of the reasons we bring them up on the Retail Focus, you might be wondering, opening three stores, that doesn't seem like a massive slew of store openings. And again, they only have 85 stores in 22 states. But the reason we talk about Sportsman's Warehouse here is we've spent so much time talking about the Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops combination. We talk about these other larger outdoor stores like Gander Mountain. Sportsman's Warehouse has a square footage that fits right in between some of these stores. They are slightly larger than the average Academy outdoor store, but at the same time, slightly smaller than most of the Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's, which also allows them to fit into certain other locations, especially popular real estate locations that are populated with other up-and-coming retailers. Their average square footage sits around 46,000 square feet. They have stores as large as 65,000 square feet and stores as small as about 30,000 square feet. So they sit right in between those other stores that we mentioned, despite occupying roughly the same space in the marketplace. Now, they don't sell quite as much activewear and that type of thing as Academy does. You know, Academy Sports and Outdoors will sell things like baseball gloves and bats, basketball equipment, football equipment. Sportsman's Warehouse is pretty much exclusively devoted to outdoors. So hunting, camping, backpacking, that type of thing. They're a little bit closer towards the hunting and fishing than, say, a retailer like REI, which occupies a similar spot in the marketplace, but at a little bit of a higher price point. So Sportsman's Warehouse is a unique retailer, and I think that's what we're trying to drive home here with this three-store acquisition. Leighton mentioned how much white space they see throughout the United States, and they've operated pretty much on the West Coast or from Colorado on west. But as Leighton mentioned, they do have developments going on east of the Rockies and even east of the Mississippi with that development in North Carolina. They've tried hard, it would appear, to stay out of competition with the likes of Cabela's and Bass Pro. But the question now going forward for Sportsman's Warehouse, how much can they compete with those companies considering that their floor model is a little bit more flexible?
Yeah, their strategy of really opening stores in the states they feel comfortable in is one that should be questioned. Obviously, they have a lot of opportunity in the Midwest, as we had mentioned prior. You see a lot of states with zero stores for Sportsman's Warehouse. But if you look at their overall demographic, you're seeing that they are focused, as you mentioned, on the hunting and shooting aspects of their business. And so I think they are focused on the states that do have a lot of big game hunters. And I think that is really what ties into their bottom line. But you see hunting and shooting coming in on their website as one of the first tabs. You see under shopping and then archery, fishing, and camping. So you can see that that's probably the order in which they want people to recognize their business with. So you see their e-commerce site does offer a lot of ship-to-store options, which is really good for a company that is competing in a space that really doesn't have a lot of omni-channel operations. You see a lot of other companies just primarily offering an in-store experience, but here is a company that is now publicly traded, so they have to recognize the fact that people want to buy online and pick up in-store to really experience the in-store process, but to also get items at their convenience. So I think this is going to be a way that people can avoid the shipping costs for the company in a way that the company can really execute on brand awareness.
One final thing of note regarding Sportsman's Warehouse is as recently as 2015, they were experimenting with a few locations that are under 20,000 square feet, and they feel like these locations are even more versatile and they can open up in what they say are high user markets with a smaller format store that allows them to not sacrifice merchandise quality or their customer service while still managing to fit into the real estate that they're able to acquire. Our final story involves brick and mortar retail giant Walmart. Seems like it's been a while since we've talked about Walmart on the show, but in this circumstance, not maybe the best of news for Walmart, as they're looking to cut another 1,000 jobs or so. They restructure management at regional and corporate levels. Now, it should be noted that this isn't necessarily in response to flagging brick and mortar sales, as some have indicated, but rather this is part of what appears to be a larger plan to put more eggs into the e-commerce basket and streamline things on the brick and mortar level.
Yeah, and this is an interesting story because none of this has really been confirmed by Walmart. However, in a statement to CNBC, Walmart said, as we previously shared, we are always looking for ways to operate more efficiently and effectively. And while we continually look at our corporate structure, we have not made any announcements. So this is basically alluding to the fact that they are looking to lay off a certain amount of employees. But several industry insiders did say it will be tallied up to about 1,000 jobs in total. And these jobs are looking to actually be cut by January 31st. And this is according to a report from the Wall Street Journal. Overall trend, if you look at the company, if you look at Walmart as a whole, they employ a lot of people here in the United States. They currently employ 1.4 million people. So they're actually the largest private employer in the United States, which is something a lot of people tend to forget about when we talk about how Walmart primarily is focused on reducing payroll. Well, in fact, they are the largest employer, so they need to be cut some slack in that arena. But overall, if you look at the amount of layoffs that the company has undergone in the past 2 years, they top 7,400. And so that's a lot of people and a lot of positions. But as you alluded to, most of these positions, at least in this latest round, are going to be tied to the corporate and regional operations for the company. It's rumored that Walmart is going to be laying off around 200 VP spots and will be cutting around 200 vice president job spots and then several hundred regional HR representatives. So again, none of this has been confirmed as of late, but it seems among several media reports that this is what's going to be happening before January 31st. But this comes at a time when the company is really truly trying to realign itself and become a true omni-channel company with a strong, robust internet platform. And this also comes as changes have occurred in their e-commerce segment. You talk about executive changes. They've been announcing over the past week several changes in executive leadership, and Jet.com founder Mark Lohr and the Walmart president Doug McMillon have announced that the company needs more speed and agility, and that they need less bureaucracy, and they also need to stay lean and fast. And so this really ties into the idea that their e-commerce business is up against a lot of competitive pressures, and fast is definitely a key word here, because you see a lot of companies coming in and offering these two-day free shipping or same-day shipping, same-hour shipping in some cases. So this is at a point where Walmart has a robust logistics program, a massive overall infrastructure, yet they just have not been able to utilize it to the amount that they want to. But I think through these executive changes, they will be making this company a little bit more fresh, a little bit more agile and to serve their customer. But if you look, Bentonville, Arkansas still houses around 18,000 people. So again, if you look at this overall amount of layoffs, it will provide some agility, but this is actually going to be less than 1% of their total payroll.
And one thing I want to reiterate, which is something you discussed, but I did not mention at the top of the story, is again, these 1,000 layoffs are rumored layoffs. They haven't been confirmed nor denied by Walmart headquarters. So looking ahead, make sure and take this information with a grain of salt. But you mentioned that Walmart does catch a lot of flack anytime they execute layoffs. And I'd like to draw your attention to the hiring pages at Walmart, especially for Walmart corporate. We talk about the potential of these 1,000 layoffs here, but we're not talking about the many, many job titles and job descriptions and new employment positions that Walmart has created basically from scratch over the last couple of years. This reminds me a lot of the story that we were covering at this time last year, where we were talking about Walmart leaving the express concepts, leaving the neighborhood market concepts. Everyone was up in arms talking about how Walmart is dying, brick and mortar is dying, all of this, because no one looked at the number of stores Walmart was opening. Overall, even if layoffs are executed by Walmart, it's part of a larger company plan as they continually adjust. They are hiring in more marketing positions. They have more digital marketing positions now than they've ever had before. And part of that is adjustment with the times. When we had Erica Hall on, and she's a reporter with KNWA in Northwest Arkansas, she was talking about the shareholder day last year and the large conference that goes with it, the number of former Walmart employees that were picketing outside and protesting and that type of thing. Their largest complaint was that basically their job got eliminated, but at the same time, they admitted that they didn't more or less stay up with the necessities of the job. And as retail has changed, as Walmart has changed, so too it is necessary to change your staffing levels and change your position, as it is with any other business. And if Walmart sees some of these positions as redundant or antiquated now in the current landscape, especially since, keep in mind, they did acquire Jet.com last year in 2016, then they need to go through with whatever they feel is right, because they do have that fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders. As much as it would be nice to talk about everyone in this circumstance retaining jobs, keep in mind that Walmart also creates dozens and dozens of new jobs every year. And as Leighton, you mentioned, they still employ 1.4 million people, including 18,000 people at their headquarters. So even if there are layoffs of 1,000 people, this is but a drop in the bucket when you consider how many jobs Walmart has created and how many jobs, new jobs and new positions Walmart creates every year. Now, I want to address the e-commerce information that Leighton was talking about. Also, we hear this week that Jet.com or Walmart has officially acquired ShoeBuy, which is an e-commerce site based out of Boston that is thought to be in competition with Zappos. So Walmart trying to position themselves, keep in mind Zappos run by Amazon, Walmart trying to position themselves as more of an e-commerce competitor to Amazon in the next few years. But all of this talk about making Walmart leaner, making Walmart faster and quicker to respond, that's stuff that we've known for quite some time. And that's part of the reason why they made the acquisition of Jet.com, is because their e-commerce site had not only been bulky and difficult to navigate, but you were seeing in some cases shipping times of 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes it would take a week or two to get an item site to store. And with a distribution mechanism as large as what Walmart has, something the company has noted is that they've got to find a way to tap into that to make things quicker for the end user, not only on their end.
Absolutely. And keeping along with the theme of executive changes and tying that into Jet.com, again, we mentioned Mark Lohr, the founder of Jet.com. He is currently now the president and CEO of their e-commerce division, of Walmart's e-commerce division. And so this week, there were additional changes that were announced. Scott Hilton, who was previously the chief revenue officer at Jet.com, is promoted to the chief revenue officer overseeing Walmart's owned merchandising, selling, and marketplace sellers initiative. And then also you have the announcement of Karenin Terrell leaving the company. She's the company's CIO. This is Walmart company CIO. She's going to be departing by February 24th. So a lot of changes with the company. And this comes as news as Sam's Club CEO Rosalind Brewer is leaving the company after 5 years leading the bulk retailer. Again, she joined the role in 2012. And in a statement by the CEO of Walmart, Doug McMillon, they said that she wants a new challenge. And so a lot of things here targeting executives, targeting change in hopes to make Sam's Club and Walmart a better, more efficient company down the line. But this is interesting to me because Rosalind Brewer was actually at the forefront of a lot of omnichannel initiatives that Sam's Club brought in. We talk about club pickup being very important for the company in the past year or so, really boosting sales as far as that omnichannel platform is concerned. And then also just really making the Sam's Club website a little bit more efficient, a little bit more user-friendly, especially towards the holidays. You see that increasing holiday sales have come by way of the online segment for Sam's Club. So interesting changes for the company. But we should note that Rosalind Brewer, if you look at the past Sam's Club CEOs, they've gone on to massive success. We talk about Brian Cornell, which was another previous Sam's Club CEO, who's now the CEO at Target. And then Doug McMillon, of course, who's the CEO of Walmart, was also a former Sam's Club CEO. So we wish her the best, as she was ranked number 19th on Fortune's Most Powerful Women list last year.
I think many people assess Brewer as one of the best CEOs in retail overall, but she's regarded as one of the most powerful female CEOs, certainly in retail. Currently, you talked about her ranking on Forbes' Most Powerful Women list. Sam's Club only has one quarter of negative same-store sales in the last 2 years during her reign, which is truly remarkable, especially considering the beating oftentimes that a lot of brick-and-mortar outlets get, whether it's media or otherwise. We've seen a lot of retail companies have more quarters than that of negative same-store sales, even if a rebound follows. She was able to keep the ship very consistent over the last several years. And as you mentioned, Layton, we wish her the best as she moves forward from Sam's Club into another challenge, as the press release says. We should also note that this seems very much like, from the outside looking in, that it was initiated by Brewer. It's not necessarily the company forcing her out. It seems as though Walmart very pleased with her performance over the last 5 years.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We finish this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast, as we do every week, with an opportunity to look ahead, each one of us, to a story that we're eyeing over the next week or month. And we begin with Layton and a home improvement retailer.
Yeah, and this is something we have been alluding to over the past 6 months or so. With Lowe's, as they shift to a more robotic approach, they're looking at a new staffing model, which they've been alluding to over the past few months. It was reported on Thursday of this week that the giant home improvement retailer will be laying off less than 1% of their overall workforce. They did not specify as to what workers they're going to be laying off, but they said that they want to make changes to initiate more FaceTime with customers. They feel like the customer service aspect of their business is lacking. However, you and I had questioned whether laying off associates will actually actually increase the time people spend with the associates there at the specific stores. But we mentioned a program they're rolling out in a pilot market a few months ago. We're talking about a robotic system where the customers can come into the store and interact with an Android, really basically asking where certain items in the store may be, and the Android will actually show them or direct them to that particular location. So it's unclear as to whether they're going to be tying these layoffs in with a program such as that, but they said they definitely need more emphasis on the customer experience. In total, Lowe's currently has a workforce over 285,000 people. So again, cutting around 1% or less than 1% of the overall jobs. But this reshuffling comes at a time when these companies are really trying to differentiate themselves, really trying to come at the forefront of people's minds when it comes to customer service. And Home Depot, as of late, has been doing really well as far as the customer service aspect in their stores.
I turned my attention to the retail pharmacy sector, where it was announced on Thursday, January 12th, that CVS would be selling a generic Adrenaclick treatment. This is based off of Impax's Laboratories Adrenaclick treatment. This is a different form of the EpiPen. It's not the same type of medication exactly, but it works in much the same way. EpiPen, of course, made by Mylan Laboratories, has come under increased scrutiny because oftentimes, the shelf price, even of a generic, would be $300, of the name brand, as much as $500. CVS is selling a two-pack of this generic Adrenaclick treatment for $109.99. So that leaves it at about $55 per pen, nearly 10% the price of Mylan's name brand EpiPen. So a significant decrease. The reason I'm looking at this story is because I believe you're going to see a lot of insurance companies begin to stop supporting the EpiPen treatment and begin to support this particular generic or the Adrenaclick treatment. And in fact, just as I say that, I noted earlier before I came on air that Cigna, the large health insurance giant, has changed to the cheaper generic EpiPen instead of the name brand EpiPen. So it's my belief that you might see some insurance companies switching and saying that maybe the Adrenaclick treatment is the one that they will back instead of the EpiPen treatment. So regardless of what this does for Mylan Laboratories, what this could do is give CVS the inside edge. Any way a retail pharmacy can boost their back end, their pharmacy sales, they'll go after it. And this is not one of the areas that CVS remarked upon in their last investor presentation as far as generic potential. They talked about generics for Viagra and Cialis coming out very soon and about the potential in those. This wasn't mentioned, so perhaps even more top-line revenue potential coming from this for CVS, aside from the impact that it could have on consumers. Additionally, we forget that if consumers are going into a retail pharmacy to pick up a prescription, oftentimes they will buy something from the front end as well, even though front end sales lag far behind back end sales in a retail pharmacy. So CVS might be able to win over consumer market share from the likes of Walgreens and other commercial drugstores if they're able to make this notoriety from the adoption of this generic version really pay off for them.
Yeah, and not only is it going to save customers who really need this device over 80% in stores, but this is really going to offer some very positive PR for the pharmacy chain CVS. You talk about the outrage over the prices that was widely reported in the summertime. A lot of outrage for potential price gouging from the EpiPen provider. So this is going to be good news for those that will be utilizing the Adrenaclick going forward.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast. A reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast for more information throughout the week as Layton continues to update and retweet stories that we find relevant to the world of retail. You can also check us out online at RetailFocusPodcast.com, where we've got some blog entries up there describing our outlook on the world of retail. Additionally, check out our Food Focus Podcast, which will come out Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. Next week's Retail Focus will be a special one as we interview the makers of a documentary that documented the closing of a discount store in South Dakota. Compelling stuff. Be sure and check it out next week. For Layton, I'm Trent. So long until then.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.